In just a moment, Karen's going to play a special for us. And before she does that, I'd like for us to hear the word. And so I invite you to stand out of reverence for the reading of God's word. It's Revelation chapter 4, verse 1 through chapter 5, verse 5. After this, I looked, and there in heaven a door stood open, and the first voice which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and there in heaven stood a throne with one seated on the throne. And the one seated there looks like jasper and carnelian, and around the throne is a rainbow that looks like an emerald. Around the throne are 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones are 24 elders dressed in white robes with golden crowns on their heads. Coming from the throne are flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, and in front of the throne burn seven flaming torches, which are the seven spirits of God. And in front of the throne there is something like a sea of glass, like crystal. Around the throne and on each side of the throne are four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind, the first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with a face like a human face, and the fourth living creature like a flying eagle. And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and inside. Day and night, without ceasing, they sing, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to the one who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall before the one who is seated on the throne and worship the one who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, singing, "Thou art worthy, thou art worthy, thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory, glory and honor, glory and honor and power. For thou hast created, hast all things created. Thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are created. For thou hast worthy, O Lord." And then I saw on the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." Amen. You may be seated. Thank you. Mrs. Bridges shared about a book called From Main Street to Managua. And I wanted to share about that particular book because I heard a story there that really impressed me. And it was about how some volunteer teams were taking the Jesus film to various places in the Horn of Africa. And there were all these little Nile River offshoots, very remote river communities, places where they could really only get to by riverboat. And they would evangelize by riverboat and present the Jesus film and get out and set up and have this service, present the good news of the gospel through video. It's a place that's heavy with tribal warfare, where the cholera epidemic is rampant, and the church is there, ministering. And there's one person who actually said that when the Jesus film team came, said, "I didn't know Jesus could speak our language. We've heard of this guy, but I didn't know he could talk our language." And so they show the Jesus film in their native language. And one of the things that happened is, while maybe the villagers didn't know the story completely, they knew enough to know injustice when they saw it. And so there were points in the video and in the movie where the villagers threw stones at the screen in protest when the soldiers crucified Jesus. And there were other points where, when Jesus died, they wailed and they sobbed at his death. Just getting to know Jesus, they may possibly not have known what Jesus did deserve, but they knew for sure what he did not deserve. The beginning of worship is recognizing what Jesus does not deserve. There's that point in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, where Jesus is going around, and this is actually his calling of Simon Peter the disciple. And it's a point where he's trying to fish and he's not catching anything. And Jesus says, "You're letting down on the wrong side," or "let down on this side." And Peter says, "I've done it, but I'll do it again if you tell me to." So he let down on that side, and the catch was so full that when it occurred, Peter was humbled. He knew he was in the presence of divinity. He dropped down, and his words, you know the confession, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." We know that if there's one thing that Jesus deserves, he deserves our worship. And the beginning of worship is recognizing what Jesus does not deserve. He does not deserve our sinfulness. But he still calls us. And I think it's so appropriate that the book of the Bible that's most rich with the language of worship comes to us in the language of a man's dream. Revelation. The New International Bible Commentary says, "The world of dreams is akin to that less ordered imaginative part of us that becomes active only when our dominant intellectual equipment lies dormant." Basically, he's saying, sometimes we dream things because our brains have stopped working, and it has to express and work itself out because our minds refuse to express it. And so how appropriate that worship comes out. We come here to worship out of a confession that we know the one to whom worship is due. But I think if there is a problem, it's that we have lost ourselves with a failure to imagine a worship more true than yesterday, and a glory that purifies our today, and to honor Jesus with a firm hope in tomorrow. This revelation material, it's the kind of writing that lends itself to what is talked about in the book of Acts. When there's an outpouring of the Spirit and there's a quoting of Joel that says, "Your young men shall see visions and your old men shall dream dreams." Something is wrong has happened in church when all we can see is what is here, and when our dreams are no longer about what could happen or what does happen, but possibly what has happened. We must ask ourselves, when was the last time I dreamed a dream that was not about remorse or unspoken reflection on what has happened, not about some suppression, but was about anticipation or even fear, but most of all about God? That we dream things that long to express themselves that are being buried in our lives. I have this recurring dream. Every time I stop getting enough exercise, I have a dream that I need to run. And sometimes my dream manifests itself as I have this unbelievable ability to run, and I can run and leap, and I practically fly. I leap for 30, 40 feet at a time, and it's like I'm flying. But then there are other dreams. And those dreams are, it's like, I can run as hard as I want. And it's like I'm going in water, just slogging through, and I can't make any progress anywhere. Do you ever have dreams that express something? And perhaps it's even possible that when we lack exercise and practicing the words of worship and lifting up and exalting God, it's got to work itself out, because we're created for this. And when we don't let it work itself out, it begins to wreak bad things in our lives. It begins to poison us. It has to be expressed. It's because worship is something that must overwhelm our consciousness and spill over into our subconscious. Is this why we fail to dream anymore about these things? Something that overwhelms our consciousness and spills into our subconscious and has to be shared, has to be expressed, experienced. I think I've shared with you in the past about my call to being called to ministry, and it was brought about by this pull or this drawing to go to another city on a faith journey. A friend of mine and I went, and we went to the town of my mother's childhood, to the church where she grew up, of all places. I'd never been there before, didn't know how to get there. And that's where we were led to go. And they were just happened to be in revival. And it was there that I felt called to be a minister. And that's a very real and powerful thing in my life. But there's also a deeper and an earlier experience where I experienced God in a dream that scared me awake. I mean, at least I think it was a dream. It was something like in this small town in Ohio where we lived. I was sleeping, and in my dream, I was awakened and lured by this voice. And I keep hearing this voice, and I walk through the house, which I must have been asleep because I would have been too afraid to do that if I was really awake. But I walk through the house to the other side of the house, walk down the stairs into the basement, and walk through a dark basement all the way to the other side, which would have been just underneath my bedroom. And as I'm there, I hear this voice that seems to be coming from this drain, some sort of drain. And I look at this drain and I get down in it, and there's some sort of like air that's being effused from it. And as I look at it, the air is blowing. It blows my hair back. It's the kind that's hard to see. It makes you want to close your eyes. And it's the kind of air that takes your breath away. And as I'm trying to get my breath and I'm hearing my name being called from somewhere, I ask the question, "Where are you?" And immediately I hear a deep voice suddenly and clearly, and it says, "Here I am." And I turn around and Jesus is standing right behind me. And then I woke up. I have thought about that time over and over and over. It always surprises me that I didn't say, "Who are you?" or "What is this?" But it was this, "Where are you?" And "Here I am." And I begin to wonder if the call in our lives is so deep and present and subversive and continually there that whether it ever comes out of the drain or whether it ever meets in St. Louis in the church of your mother's hometown, is there that subversive call to worship and relationship that's just there, calling your name and saying, "I know you, you're mine, and I want you"? That was my experience. And I'm not taking credit for anything. I think it's merely the faith of a child and the imminent presence of a God who speaks to those with childish faith or childlike faith. That I don't dream about God a whole lot anymore, but man, that one was real. When do we stop dreaming about God? And I think there's something deep within and alongside John the Revelator, the guy who wrote Revelation, that tells me that this is not a childishness that we should be growing out of so much as it's a faith that we should be growing into. Are we hearing Him speak to us anymore? Are we aware of His very subversive but real presence? I mean, subversive and real. that's there, and we catch glimpses, and we hear, and we see, and we catch a glimpse, and we say, did I just see what I thought I saw? This is the stuff that John's apocalypse is made of. That's the Greek word for revelation, apocalypse. This is the stuff it's made of. It's the stuff of the deeper reality of our lives. Because there is the person that we all show ourselves to be when we come to worship service, but then there is the honest person that we are, that is knowingly weak and knowingly fearful and knowingly unworthy. And if the church is that place where we are to be vulnerable and open to transformation before a transcendent and holy God, I believe that if that's true, then no wonder the youth of our culture will continue to seek out other means of transcendence for the sicknesses that they experience. Because for some reason we're lacking this transcendent presence of a holy God when we come together and we're not honest about why we're here or who we lift up. There's only one remedy for the illness of fallen humanity, and it is the worship of this one who has redeemed the inner depths of the human experience and healed the heart of humanity with his suffering and offered himself in love to the glory of God. He is why we are here. He is why we do everything we do. So how do we live this kind of life that exudes worship and glory to the one who is worthy? It's this one who's described in Revelation chapter 1 as the one whose voice sounds like the sound of many waters. We're talking about a transition from staying awake at night and worrying about the frets and the cares of the world and exchanging those for the active dreams of a world not yet fully come. But it is arriving. And I want to be found there. And it leads us to the question, what needs to change about my waking hours in order for my dreams to continue glorifying Jesus? And I'm not just talking about things that happen in our sleep. This is about the subversive imagination in which Christ lures us into a more real life, one that does not end when we die. It's one consumed with the presence of God and living in that glory each moment. It's the subversive imagination of expression. And so we see in Revelation just a picture of what is actually happening all the time. Spontaneous worship and adoration of the Christ, who is the worthy recipient of our devotion. And the spontaneous worship includes the breaking into song, this hymn that we hear, which I'm sorry for my singing, but I just had determined I wouldn't just read through it. Because it's something that's going on right now. It's not something, when we talk about eternity, when we talk about heaven, it's not something out there then when. It's something that's happening and going on right now. It's the realm of God's residence. And so these four living creatures who are full of eyes, and what we understand, that means that they're full of insight and knowledge. They worship Him and they proclaim, holy, holy, holy. Because it's a way of confessing, those who know and understand, they worship. And then there are 24 elders of this heavenly court, and they worship, probably representing 12 patriarchs of the tribes of Israel of the Old Testament, and then 12 apostles of the New Testament. And what they do is they then take these golden crowns off their heads and they throw them at the feet of the throne. And we've heard that phrase, casting crowns, these casting of their crowns before the throne. It's a very powerful word because the word is used elsewhere in Revelation in a very different way. It's more like the word throw. In fact, it's used in the rest of Revelation, it's used in a sort of judgmental manner in which angels are carrying out the judgment of God. And it's done almost in the sense of things being hurled. And so in chapter 5, I believe it's chapter 5, There's a manner of judgment in which an angel is throwing a censer of fire from the altar to the earth, and it results in peals of thunder and rumblings and flashes of lightning and an earthquake, that these elders are not just worshiping God, and they're not just taking their crowns and walking up and setting them down. They're taking them off and they're throwing them at his feet because they realize all that I am and any sovereignty I might possibly claim for myself. Because remember, the sin is the delusion of self-sovereignty, that I actually am in control. They throw it at his feet because he is sovereign and God and Lord. It's with this level of assertion that the elders, they throw their crowns at the foot of the throne. And as my sovereign, there's nothing about my life that does not fall under the lordship of Jesus. I surrender my allegiances, my ambitions, my desires to Christ, who has demonstrated his authority. And he is more than trustworthy. He is to be validated by my life, affirmed by my confession. And what I do and what I'm a part of should just glorify him and worship him continually. That to do anything less than offer complete surrender and worship is a dishonor to the one who was slain on my behalf. Throwing rocks at the video screen. He doesn't deserve anything less than my complete allegiance. And while this is the occurrence that John experiences as one who's caught up beyond the crystal sea, I love that language, it is something we find going on not merely as an earthly enterprise. It's not something that's, or even as just some eternal, something that begins when everything else ends. It's something that is the business of heaven now. That the whole population of heaven is in complete worship to the one who has overcome the sting of death and who is ultimately to marry heaven and earth. When we enter into worship, we are joining that which the court of heaven is already doing. We are joining the business of heaven, what they are already engaged in, lifting up Jesus the Christ. There's a pastor at a pastor's conference I went to about 5 years ago named Sam Vassell. He's a Jamaican pastor who pastors in the Bronx, New York. And he shared a story about his days when he was attending Wheaton. And he said there was this church that he would often go to. He called it Incognito. He secretly would go there because it was a different tradition. It was Assemblies of God. And he said he would go to this church and he would often meet one of his professors there who was Presbyterian. And they would look at each other and say, well, here you are again. What are you doing here? And he said the Presbyterian professor confessed, we Presbyterians tend in our worship to reflect on what God did in the past. But these people seem to just be excited about what is going on right now. That this is what heaven's about right now. He said, as a Nazarene, I had to say the same thing. Sometimes we reflect on what God's done, but what about this moment? And what about the moments that follow that we find ourselves in? That perhaps what we should claim and confess is that we come to proclaim that this God worthy of heaven's praise is first of all a holy God, and that we extend this worship beyond Sunday into the week where we continue worshiping with holy lives of consecration. That is our worship. What kind of worshiping people will we be? What kind of worshiping people will we be? I just finished a book by a man named Dennis Covington, who's a journalist. And he wrote a story about his experiences with a remnant of a community of snake handling worshipers. And in all his wrestling, he journaled this, but in all his wrestling, somehow he came to a renewed faith in God and eventually handled snakes himself. And in wrestling with worship in its various forms, he came to eventually, in the end, he diverged with the snake handlers on a point of dissension. But interestingly enough, it was not the snakes that he disagreed with them about. It was because they failed to recognize the legitimacy of women as valid proclaimers of the gospel, they would not ordain women. And he said, we just had to part ways there. It wasn't the snakes, it was the women. Well, the book ends with a reflection of his childhood and how he experienced his call home each evening from a summer's day. And I wanted to share with you a few words that he says. He said, it's late afternoon at the lake. The turtles are moving closer to shore. The surface of the water is undisturbed, an expanse of smooth gray slate. Most of the children in my neighborhood are called home for supper by their mothers. They open the back doors, wipe their hands on their aprons, and they yell, Willie, or Joe, or Ray. Either that or they use a bell that's bolted to the door frame and loud enough to start the dogs barking in backyards all along the street. But I was always called home by my father. And he didn't do it in the customary way. He walked down the alley, all the way to the lake. If I was close, I could hear his shoes on the gravel before he came into sight. If I was far, I would see him across the surface of the water, emerging out of shadows and into the gray light. He would stand with his hands in the pockets of his windbreaker while he looked for me. This is how he got me to come home. He always came to the place where I was before he called my name. He's a gracious God from beyond the glassy sea who comes near in physical presence. And it's like Moses, who after coming near and sensing there was something holy about this space, it's only after he sees the bush burning and stops that he then hears God calling his name. Moses. Moses. Just like Moses, his father always comes to the place where he was before he calls his name. Let me tell you, God is not calling your name from somewhere elsewhere far away. This crystal sea has been traversed. This great divide and chasm has been crossed. And God is present in your life. And I don't know if he's come in a dream. I don't know if he's coming, if he has come in the waking hours. I don't know if it's been a voice out of a dream. But I know he's calling you. And he's calling you to worship and to let your life exude and flow that worship. It's this subversive, imaginative expression for which we were created that has to be let out for us to truly become who we are to be. God is with you. He's present. He's calling you. Reflect on it. Recognize his presence and worship the Holy One who alone is worthy of praise. Amen.